You hungry? There's mac and cheese.
Score. His eyes widened. I stuck out my hand. He took it, and I led him inside.
Ira! Where have you been? You scared Mommy to death!
His mom shrieked when she saw him.
Come here!
He dropped my hand.
I want mac and cheese,
he announced as he started over to her. My mom, smiling calmly at the onlooking table as she passed them, said to me,
What happened? If we'd had to call the police, I never would have lived it down. Can you imagine?
He just wandered out this door, I said, pulling it shut behind me so she wouldn't see the dog. Next time we'll know to keep an eye on it if there are kids here.
Next time I'll keep the ring bearer on a leash, she grumbled, then looked at her phone.
William is reporting everyone's going rogue at the buffet. He needs muscle.
I'm on it,
I said. No, you found the lost child. She squared her shoulders, readjusting the diamond pendant she always wore to the center of her neck. Take 5 minutes, then go find the caterer to talk cake cutting.
Okay.
She squeezed my arm, then started over to the buffet line, which had indeed become snaky and fidgeting in our absence. I opened the door again, slipping out into the loading bay. Ambrose was crouched down in front of the dog, scratching his ears.
Who's a hero? That's right, you are. Good boy.
I could see a cloud of wiry hair coming off the dog, rising into the light behind him.
I thought you and I just saved the day.
He glanced back at me.
Because Ira here told us where to look. You heard that bark? It was like breadcrumbs through the forest.
Of course it was. You're calling him Ira now?
It's his name.
He was still scratching, the cloud of hair growing wider. How could a dog shed so much and not be bald?
That was his way of telling us.
The barking, I said, clarifying.
Yep.
Ira! I called out. The dog didn't even look at me, much less bark. I looked at Ambrose.
Do you always answer to your name?
He asked. I sighed. Even without the drama of a lost child, this wedding felt longer than others.
I have to go deal with the cake. Are you coming?
I started back around the building, having decided to take the long way for some extra fresh air. A moment later, he fell into step beside me, brushing his hands against each other.
I have to hand it to you. This job is harder than it looks.
What did it look like?
Standing around while being bossy, he replied.
I raised my eyebrows.
Luna, you literally dragged me into my mother's ceremony by one arm.
You were holding up the schedule, I replied, hating how prim I sounded.
My point is, there's a lot behind the scenes the layman or guest would never know about,
like a secret world. I rolled my eyes. You make it sound magical.
You don't think it is?
I think it's work, I replied.
Magical work.
He laughed at the face I made, hearing this, then added,
You know, you can act the part all you want, but my take on you is you're not as cynical as you make yourself out to be.
You have a take on me now?
I have a take on everyone. I'm an observer, a witness.
Usually those people listen more than they talk, I pointed out.
Maybe.
He slipped his hands into his pockets, shaking that curl out of his eyes.
My point is, I've been around you a lot the last few days, and I've seen things.
Well, I said, that doesn't sound ominous at all.
A cynic, he continued, ignoring this, would not have looked as relieved as you did when we found Ira. Also, a cynic would have made sure the boss knew whose dog caused the lost child to wander off in the first place. You, instead, covered for me and Ira, the dog.
I think you're confusing a cynic with an asshole, I told him.
Maybe. But I saw how you reacted, both times. You're not that hardened yet, even if you prefer to think otherwise.
A car drove around us, the bass thumping. I said, The key word is yet.
It is, he agreed, because you still have a choice in the matter.
Or it's only a matter of time, I countered.
Okay, now you sound like a cynic.
He tipped his head back, looking up at the stars overhead.
But you're not fooling me. I know what I saw.
To this, I said nothing. What was the point? It wasn't like I was proud of my hard little rock of a heart. Everyone's life shapes them in their own unique way. No one could really understand how the events of the last year, highs and lows, had honed me into what I now was, sharper in places, more calloused in others. And of course, I'd been worried about a lost child. I wasn't a monster. Yet. We were back at the front doors to the club now, where a large party was exiting the reception, cigars in hand. As we approached, two men, suits rumpled and cheeks rosy, opened a door for us at the same time. In reply, Ambrose spread his arms, clearly loving an entrance. Before he stepped in, though, he turned his head, cupping a hand to his mouth.
Ira! He called out.
Of course, the dog barked.
Call me crazy,
my mom said, loosening the strap of one of her shoes. But I'm thinking they might go the distance.
Natalie Barrett! William gave her a warning look. Don't you dare tell me you've become an optimist.
I don't think I can take it.
Never,
she replied, as he topped off both their glasses, then dropped the bottle with a clank back into the ice bucket. I just got that sense. They don't seem like the divorce type.
Which is the same as being married happily, yes?
My mom considered this as she took a sip of her drink. I don't think it's that simple. There's a whole spectrum between those two, at least in my experience. Like all the variations of gray. William didn't seem to buy it, even before he said,
Gray is gray, as far as I'm concerned.
I disagree. She eased the other strap, wincing as she did so. I remember being so unhappy at times in my own marriage for various reasons. And yet the thought of it ending, of choosing to do that, I never would have even thought of it. And if I had, I'm sure I would have considered it the much worse option.
Worse than being unhappy?
Well, yes, she replied. Like, in a marriage, it's not just whether you see the glass is half full or half empty. It's whether you see it those two ways or any of the other endless fractions that are possible. William winced.
This conversation is making my head hurt. I give them 6 years, and she leaves for someone else. 3 kids.
My mom leaned her head to the side, considering this.
I don't know.
What do you think, Luna? I blinked, not having expected to be asked to weigh in. This was their game, not mine, even though I had seen Charlotte and her groom laughing happily as they climbed into the car to leave together. For them, and her in particular, I wished they'd always put each other first. Out loud, though, I said,
I have no idea. Smart girl! William raised his glass at me.
She who doesn't gamble can never lose.
Or win, my mom pointed out.
Details,
he replied, and they both laughed, then clinked glasses. I felt a yawn coming on and reached up, covering my mouth, wishing we could just go ahead and do our final sweep so we too could head home. Before that would happen, though, I had to collect all the vases we'd rented from the tables, and I wasn't about to do it alone. Ambrose, however, was nowhere in sight. Just as I thought this, I heard voices from over by the back door where Ira had escaped. When I turned, there Ambrose was with, of all people, Julie, the annoying maid of honor. She was holding her shoes in one hand, the throne bouquet, which, as William predicted, she dived for with vigor in the other. As Ambrose said something to her, she tipped her head back and laughed again, putting a hand on his arm. There's something messy about people at the end of weddings. Clothes, once pressed, are rumpled and creased. Hair escapes from chignons and gets wild from dancing. Makeup runs, as do stockings and tights, and women almost always shed their shoes, men their jackets. There's nothing neat about that feeling when the finiteness of the event hits, and you're suddenly more aware than ever that tomorrow is just another regular day. Maybe this was what made people drag out the night, stretching the time left a little longer. I understood it. I'd done it. But we were working here, not attending. Ambrose could get messy off the clock. I wanted to go home. Hey, I called out, and they both looked over at me. Let's grab these vases so we can start getting out of here.
Sure thing, boss, he replied. Be there in 5 seconds.
The boss thing was new, since an incident earlier when I told him that no, he couldn't accept when one of the bridesmaids asked him to dance. I assumed he'd known this already, having extended the same offer to me at his own mother's wedding. My assumptions were always wrong when it came to Ambrose.
No dancing?
He said, once I'd told him to decline. Still, I could feel the bridesmaid, ever hopeful, hovering behind me.
Aren't we here to make sure the party is perfect?
You really think that much of your conga skills?
Well, no,
he replied, although clearly he did. But a good wedding is at least 95% based on a great dance floor experience. I can help with that. In the business less than a week, and he was quoting statistics. Made up ones, but statistics. We're not here to enjoy the party. We're here to make sure everyone else does. What if their enjoyment could be enhanced by us contributing our own? It doesn't work that way, I said, as a girl in her late 20s, wearing a pink dress, began crossing the floor in his direction, that telltale look on her face. What was he, a dancing magnet? Just politely say no, tell them you're working, and move off the dance floor. If you're not here, you can't be asked. He pointed at me.
That's my motto in general when it comes to dancing. You have to put yourself out there.
I looked at his finger. He lowered it slowly.
I mean, unless you're working. Sorry, boss.
I'm not your boss, I grumbled, starting toward the buffet line. When I looked back, he was shaking his head, smiling, as the girl in pink tried to lead him farther into the shifting crowd. When he backed away, she made a sad face, then mimed wiping a tear. Jesus. Just recalling this was making me even crankier, so I got to my feet, collecting the vase from the table where I'd been sitting, then the one next to it. I was all set to snap at Ambrose as he finally did come over, but then I saw he was carrying 3 others, one in each hand and another pressed to his chest.
Where should I pour these out?
He asked. Just put them in the crate for now and we'll do it outside, I said. I always hated a wedding when we had to collect equipment after the fact, preferring the ones my mom called zero footprint, where we just left it all for the venue to deal with. As I picked up another vase, I saw Julie crossing the room, shoes now on, the bouquet dangling down beside her. What was she saying to you?
Who?
I nodded at her.
Jules? Nothing much. Just wondering where an out-of-towner could grab a martini at this late hour. I told her I knew just the place.
You're going out with her tonight?
It's just a drink. And a ride for me and Ira, which is a good thing. Our dogs are tired.
Ha ha, I thought, as I walked over to the wooden rack we'd stored under the cake table and slid the vases into them. The flowers, white roses mixed with those peonies I'd caved on, had held up well, still perky as they bobbed in their water.
"So what happens to these now?" Ambrose asked as he added his vases to the rack.
"The flowers?" I asked. "Usually we toss them."
"Really? Seems wasteful."
"Maybe," I said. "But after picking them up, arranging them, putting them out on tables, and then collecting them back up, I feel like our relationship has run its full course." I could feel him watching me as I slid another vase in, a few petals falling off one rose as I did so.
Do you look at everything in terms of coupling and uncoupling? I shrugged, getting to my feet again. Unavoidable effect of the business, I guess. Grab those across the room, will you? I'll get this side.
You got it, boss.
This time, I didn't have the energy to correct him. I need to hit the bathroom, so I'll take final sweep. William called out as he and my mom, ritual completed, got up from their chairs. What's left besides that in vases? Cake top from the fridge, my mom told him. Charlotte's mom is supposed to come by the office for it first thing Monday. And then we're done, he replied, holding up a hand. She slapped him five, the champagne was showing, and they headed in their separate directions as Ambrose and I finished filling the rack and carried it outside to the van. There, in the glare of a parking lot light, we dumped the water out of the vases one by one, putting the flowers on the curb beside. By the time we were done, all I could smell were roses. So long, fellas, Ambrose told the blooms, a solemn look on his face. It's not you. It's us. I rolled my eyes, but didn't say anything, instead focusing on getting the rack secured for the trip back to the office. By the time William and my mom came out, I'd slipped my feet out of the backs of my own shoes, feeling ever closer to the night's end and my own barefoot drive home. Good job, team, my mom said as she pulled her keys out of her purse. Kudos to Ambrose and Luna in particular for finding a wayward child. Thank you, ma'am, he replied, giving her a salute. It was the least I could do for the company. William laughed. I like this kid. So dedicated. The child wouldn't have been lost if it wasn't for his dog, I wanted to say. I didn't. Monday, my mom continued, we turn our full attention to the Eleanor Lynn wedding. It's a double-hander with a very detail-oriented bride. So rest up. With that, William climbed into the van, taking off his suit jacket, while my mom headed to her car. I reached back, taking down the bun I always wore when working, then ran a hand through my hair as I dug for my own keys. When I looked up, Ambrose was getting to his feet, a bunch of the discarded blooms in his arms. He'd wrapped them with a crumpled program, fashioning a huge, trailing bouquet, which he held out to me. Oh, I said, suddenly feeling bad about how short I'd been with him all night. Not that it was exactly proper to give a coworker flowers, but still a nice gesture. You shouldn't... No? He looked down at them. You said you were throwing them out, so I thought it was okay if I took them. I heard footsteps, and then Julie stepped out from behind the next row of cars. Ambrose! You ready to go get that drink? He was still looking at me. Of course, I told him. It's fine.
See you Monday, Luna,
he said, then started over to her, holding the flowers out in greeting. Taking them, she ducked her head down to breathe in the scent, and I thought of her waiting for the bride to throw the bouquet earlier, how she'd gone into a crouch, eyes sharp, determined to be the lucky one. It was so calculated, so different from this, unexpected in that way only weddings could be. See you, I replied, not that either of them heard me as they started toward the loading bay, I assumed to collect Ira. I waited until they were out of sight before I walked back to the curb, where all the blossoms still lay, petals around them. I picked up one peony and a rose, then thought better and left them where they were. There's a difference between things given and those you simply find. Julie knew it, and I did too. I never expected anything from anyone, which was not the same thing as not wanting, ever, to be surprised. Chapter 10. Which is which? I asked, squinting into the dark pan.
Does it matter? Just dig in.
I looked at Ethan as he poked his own fork into what I thought was the slice of blueberry crumble, scooping out a huge bite. You can't just
jam them all together and make some hybrid. We got 6 flavors. Each needs to be tasted individually.
Lulu, he said, it's 1:30 in the morning, and we're sitting in the dark. Just eat.
I had a nickname now, something else I'd never experienced before. The numbers in that category just kept growing, and yet I was clearly the same Luna, compelled to add, that man clearly takes his pies seriously. The way he advised us, you would have thought we were buying a car, or life insurance.
But we weren't. Here.
The next thing I knew, his fork was up against my lips, and I smelled custard.
This one's some kind of fruity mush. It's good.
I took the bite, messily. That's the lemon-orange crumb. This I remembered specifically because it had sounded so good. Once inside the coffee shop, we discovered the owner, a guy in an eat-sleep-fish baseball hat, was closing up. At the register, a dark-haired boy and his girlfriend, clearly regulars, were getting one last hit of caffeine to go.
"Anywhere else close by to eat at this hour?"
Ethan asked them as they paid up. The girl, wearing shorts and a t-shirt that said Clementines, looked at the boy.
"World of Waffles, but it's not exactly walking distance. Or there's the Wheelhouse."
"No," the guy said flatly. "The coffee there tastes like burnt towels."
"There's a 24-hour cafe at the big club," she suggested. "Lousy coffee, but great people watching."
"Auden," the guy said. "Are you trying to give terrible suggestions?"
"At least I'm suggesting," she replied. To us, she said, "Look, this place is as good as it gets even in daylight hours. Your best bet is to take some pie and drinks to go."
"Please do," said the guy behind the counter. "I'll even give you a deal. Pie is never as good the second day."
Choosing had taken time with so many selections, all looking delicious, and the owner walking us through the particulars of each. In the end, we'd left with 2 large coffees, a pie pan filled with one of just about everything, and 2 forks. The slices looked gorgeous in the case. In the dark, though, it was all about the taste.
"Oh, man!"
Ethan sat back, whistling between his teeth, then pointed at the pan.
"This one, on the right, is it!
Chocolate and crunchy, and maybe orange?" I reached across him with my own utensil, taking some. "Pâte de crème and mandarin. He said that one was his favorite." Ethan helped himself to another huge forkful. As he moved it toward his mouth, a mandarin slipped off, landing on my arm with a splat.
"Whoops. Sorry."
"Look at you," I said as he picked it up, still chewing. There was a spot of chocolate on his nose. "You're a mess."
"Try to catch this,"
he said, rearing back with the segment. I opened my mouth. He threw it, going wide, and hit my ear.
"Bad throw. Sorry."
"Give me that," I said, taking the pie plate. I dug out another mandarin, pinching it between my fingers, and he set down his fork, readying himself, mouth open. I started laughing even before I launched it, sending it sailing over his head. He turned, watching it hit the sand.
"Well, if you were aiming for the water, I'd call that close."
"I was," I said, and then he smiled at me and reached out, pulling me in for a kiss. He tasted like chocolate, and as a breeze blew over us, swirling up sand, I closed my eyes tightly, thinking, no, now I wanted to stay in this moment forever. This was weird, I knew, as I'd only met him a few hours ago, but with our walk, the dance, all the talking, and now pie, Ethan was already familiar in his quirks and tells. The way he squinted, tightly, before saying something he felt strongly. The slow lope of his big, tall guy walk. The feeling of his class ring, cold and smooth, against my fingers when he took my hand. the trill of his ringtone, a pop song so unexpected that the first time I'd heard it, I'd had to laugh. We'd been sitting in the sand, sharing pictures on our phones. I showed him Jilly, my mom, and William, and the one picture of myself I actually liked, which had been taken under a gazebo at a wedding the previous spring. In turn, I got to see him with the guys he'd been friends with since preschool, posing shirtless, all of their hair wet and cowlicked, by a backyard swimming pool. I'd just been leaning in closer to examine a shot of him on the soccer field when the phone rang, the tone a clip of a girl singing over a bouncy, fizzy beat. "What is that?" I said, laughing as he scrambled to silence it.
"Don't do it," he said, holding up a hand. "Do not mock. You don't know the whole story."
I waited. "If you must know," he said, looking down at the phone,
"it's Lexi Navigator."
"Seriously?" All I knew about Lexi Navigator, a teenage singer with a statuesque build and a huge amount of dark hair, were the skimpy outfits and plentiful feathers and body glitter that were her trademark. She was the kind of entertainer defined by the fact that I could name at least three of her outlandish get-ups off the top of my head, but not one of her songs. I would not have guessed that.
"I said don't mock," he reminded me.
"Then tell me the story."
A sigh. Then he squinted. "Okay, so it's the beginning of junior year, and my buddy Sam's dad, who's an entertainment lawyer, gets this block of tickets to a Lexi Navigator show. We're not doing anything, and it's the whole VIP thing, limo, backstage passes, all that. So we go."
"No girls, just you?"
"What, six guys can't hit up a Lexi Navigator show in the name of male bonding? You gotta live, right?"
I bit my lip, trying not to laugh.
"So, the seats are, like, third row. We're all just laughing, making fun of the opening act, having fun. Then she comes out, and there's fireworks and confetti, and she's in this dress that shoots lasers, wearing a wire basket on her head."
"Wait, a wire basket?"
He shrugged. "That's what it looked like. And the show was crazy, right? All these greased-up dancers, balloons falling, little girls screaming all around us. Then about halfway through, she goes into this more mellow part, brings down the lights, puts a stool on the stage, takes a seat."
"Still wearing the basket?"
"No, by then she'd changed like 10 times. She had on, like, a crown of snakes and a bikini tuxedo."
"Of course she did."
"So she starts talking about the next song," he continued, "and how it was inspired by her grandmother dying the year before. And then she starts singing, and about a verse in, she's crying."
"Really?"
"Yep." He squinted. "And we're all sitting there, only a few feet away, and I can see the tears, and they're real, and suddenly I start thinking about my grandmother."
"Your grandmother's passed, too?"
"No, she's fine, healthy as a horse, which is what makes this all so stupid." He sighed. "So I'm watching, and she's crying, and I'm thinking about Nana, and, you know, maybe I get a little emotional myself."
I waited a second. Then I said, "Maybe?"
"I did," he coughed. "And unfortunately, it was seen and documented by my buddies."
I reached over, taking his hand again. "Oh, dear."
"Exactly."
He folded his fingers through mine.
"And of course, they won't let it go, even when she changes into a mermaid costume with a real flipper. They're threatening to post it everywhere, immediately, and I just want to die. And kill them. Or kill them, and then die."
I laughed. "That seems kind of extreme."
"You don't know my guys," he said. "We've been mocking each other since we were in diapers. It's like an art form. I'm never going to live this down."
"So what did you do?"
"We have this thing called striking a deal," he said, rubbing his free hand over his face. "Like an exchange program for embarrassment. You pick one to trump another. I was willing to do just about anything."
"Obviously."
"So," he continued,
I agreed to have Alexi Navigate a song as my ringtone until graduation. And if anyone asks about it, and of course they do, I have to tell them I'm her number one fan and show this picture. With that, he turned on his phone again, typing in a passcode. A few swipes, and there it was. Ethan, in a brown wood lacrosse t-shirt, next to Lexi Navigator, who was wearing a red leather bodysuit and devil horns, her face covered in glitter. You gotta live indeed. And this is better than the world knowing you cried at her song? I said, clarifying.
Of course it is, he said. This way I just look quirky, with the tears, possibly mentally unstable.
You sure about that? I asked, looking at the picture again. He made a face.
Anyway, the deal is this. If I ever don't answer by saying I'm a big fan and showing the picture and they hear about it, they'll post the video and kill me with shame. We shook on it.
I raised my eyebrows. And these are your friends? He flipped to the next picture of all of them around Lexi Navigator.
My best friends, believe it or not.
I believe it, I said, leaning against him as he moved to another picture of their group, this time in the limo. All cute, athletic boys, clean-cut and grinning. Jilly would have been in heaven. But I have a question.
She smelled great, he said. Everyone asks that.
Not my question, I replied.
Oh, sorry.
The deal is you have to say you heart Lexi and show the picture when people ask about the ringtone, correct?
Yep, until graduation.
But when I asked, I continued, you told me the real story. Why? He put the pie pan aside and turned to face me, now wrapping both of his hands around mine.
Lulu, I'm pretty much having the best night of my life. Why would I tell you anything but the truth?
I felt my face get warm hearing this. It wasn't the nickname or the assurance that I wasn't the only one who felt this night was special, although I'd turn over these things again and again later, remembering. Instead, it was this last question, the inverse of how I knew I, myself, felt concerning just about everyone else in the world. For safety's sake, we learn to be less honest at the beginnings of things, not more. But Ethan was different. With him and me, it was always about the truth. Why would I tell you anything but? It was the closest thing to I love you a boy had ever said to me. Maybe it meant even more.
Chapter 11. If you'd asked me, it was only a matter of time before something like this happened. But of course, nobody had asked me.
Is Ambrose here?
I looked up from my laptop where I'd been studying the seating arrangements for that weekend's wedding. A pretty girl in shorts and a button-down shirt, her red hair pulled back in a headband, was standing just inside the main door of the office, a picnic basket over one arm. I said, looking toward the back room. He wasn't there. He'd left a few minutes earlier with another girl, whom he'd introduced to me as Hajar. He's actually at lunch.
Oh.
Her disappointment was immediate and obvious.
Do you know where he went?
I shook my head.
Sorry.
She twisted her mouth, either pouting or thinking or both. Then she set the basket down, pulling out her phone and quickly typed in a message. A moment later, I heard a ping.
Oh,
she said. He says he's in a meeting? The fact this was phrased as a question suggested I was supposed to dispute it or at least give an answer. Instead, I just shrugged, smiling, and went back to my tables. I heard her typing something else. Then she said,
Well, I guess you can do sandwiches for dinner too, right?
I was not sure why I was still involved in this exchange. Glancing up, I saw she was watching me, again expecting a response. Guess so. At this, she smiled, like I'd said much more than these two words.
Okay if I leave a quick note? She asked, picking up a Natalie Barrett weddings pad from the table between us.
This time, she didn't wait for an answer. She just started writing. Too many tables at this wedding, I thought to myself as I went back to my work. At least it was a sit-down dinner, so we wouldn't be directing traffic at a buffet.
If you could give this to him,
the girl said, forcing me to look up again, that would be great. She was holding out a piece of paper folded into a neat square. I put it on the table above my own papers.
Sure thing. Thanks so much.
A clink, then a creak, as she hoisted the basket again and started for the door. Once outside, she slid on a pair of sunglasses before walking away. I filled in another table with names, all the while aware of the folded note nearby, Ambrose written on the top in a curling, girlish hand. I had the oddest urge to open and read it, although I had no idea why. His love life was none of my business or concern. But it was annoying to have to run interference for him while he was off having lunch and I was still working. That said, I had to admit, but would not have allowed, not to anyone, that having Ambrose as a co-worker wasn't actually all that bad. Sure, there was his tendency to break things. A stapler and tape measure had suffered the same fate as the tape dispenser in his short employ, as well as the constant chatter that now filled the time I used to spend organizing place cards in silence. But in truth, he was funny. And I often had to bite back my own laughs as he prattled on about his various misadventures while we sat working side by side. Like, perhaps, scheduling two lunches at once. I couldn't wait to hear about that one. About 20 minutes later, stomach grumbling, I took my own break, walking over to the coffee shop for an egg salad bagel. The line was long, and I ended up back by phone lady, who was set up at the window counter.
So I said, you don't have to tell me about health concerns, she was saying, her voice carrying as always. I'm a cancer survivor. 4 squamous cells in 2 years scraped off my shoulders and back, and I still managed to pay my rent and bills.
A pause, but a short one. Whoever phone lady was always talking to, they never seemed to get much of a word in.
I never wanted a tenant anyway. We renovated that garage apartment for Martin so he'd have a place for his pinball machines and model trains. That's how good I was to him. And you know how that turned out.
Ahead of me, a woman in a black business suit, an ID badge of some sort clipped to her jacket, exhaled loudly. I wanted to tell her to save her breath. I'd heard people outright tell phone lady to hush, and she barely batted an eye.
I know my rights as a landlord, she continued now, and I'm not afraid to evict, no sir, but it's just so unfortunate. I thought having someone in that apartment would be a good thing, just my luck. I don't get good things, I guess.
Hearing this, I craned my neck to see how many people were still ahead of me. I could handle phone ladies complaining, her detailed stories of the slights of co-workers and relatives, even the long-winded stories about her cat's health issues. But the sad stuff and self-pity just wasn't worth an egg salad sandwich to me. I had enough of that in my own head. Luckily, the businesswoman and guy behind her had simple orders, so soon enough I was on my way. As I pushed out the door, holding it for a man carrying a baby, phone lady was saying something about having joined a dating website. Better him than me, I thought. The stories just went on and on, whether or not anyone was there to listen. I'd planned to bring my food back to the office to eat. On my way, though, I saw Ira, tied up by a bench in a shady spot right next to the stationery store, a blue bandana around his neck. Clearly, Ambrose had discovered that the couple that owned the store, Emily and Florence, were huge animal lovers.
I was actually surprised he wasn't already just hanging out inside. When Ira saw me, he sat up, wagging his tail. "Hey, bud," I said. He responded by wiggling harder, his front end now joining in, going the opposite direction. "You thirsty?" He wasn't. His water bowl, a custom job with his name on it, something I just knew a girl had purchased for Ambrose, was full. Still, when I took a seat and untwisted my own bottle, I poured a bit in, topping him off. Obligingly, he drank. Then, after sniffing at my sandwich from a distance, his long whiskers twitching, he turned in a circle and lay at my feet, his head on my shoe. Again, I was not a dog person, or an animal person, but it seemed rude to move, so I didn't. A moment later, my phone rang. Even without the caller ID, I would have known it was Jilly, based only on the noise in the background. Children's voices engaged in some sort of argument, a baby wailing. "Hello?" I said. "Hang on," she replied. Then, "Everyone hush, I am on the phone, or no ice cream for anyone!" The noise volume dropped noticeably, although I could still hear Bean sputtering. "Hey," Jilly said to me, "what are you doing?" When I heard from Jilly while she was in the throes of sibling caregiver duty and I was doing something alone, peacefully, I was always self-conscious about it. "Working," I said, "and eating lunch. What's up?" The phone was pierced by a blood-curdling shriek, which she ignored, saying, "Oh, the regular, shuttling between food trucks and lessons, playdates and diaper changes."
"You just passed the ice cream place," I heard Crawford say in his flat monotone.
"Shit," she said. The girls howled in protest, saying something about bad words. "Oh, like you haven't heard it before. And there are other ice cream places."
"Not like that one." Crawford again.
"Can you please shut up for 1 second and let me talk to Luna?" she snapped. Silence. Temporarily. "Okay, quickly. I left it with Devin that we'd meet him and his buddy tonight at A La Carte for dinner at 7:30.
"Devin?"
I asked.
"Who's that?"
"The mock UN guy I met at the student government convention, I told you." She hadn't. But Jilly was always talking to different guys, so I wasn't exactly shocked that one had slipped her mind. "Remember? They're civilized dinner people." He had on a sport jacket, which was the equivalent of her kryptonite, but not mine, and I hadn't agreed to anything even resembling this. "Jilly, I don't want to have dinner with strangers." "And you don't want to go dancing with strangers, or go to a party with strangers. You don't want to do anything with anyone." How did we go from strangers to anyone? "Everyone will be a stranger as long as you insist on never meeting people. What happened to making memories?" I sighed, looking down at Ira, who was drooling on the pavement beside my foot. "Why do all our memories have to involve people I don't know?" "Because," she said, as Bean hollered again, "this is the summer for you to get used to meeting guys again. You have to get these first few bumpy, awful dates out of the way. Swine before pearls and all that." "And when exactly will the pearls arrive?" "In the fall at college, probably, but if you've already done this, the awkward hard part, meeting them will be easier." "So you're saying I should head into dinner tonight expecting disaster?" "Well, that's a bit strong. More likely a lack of chemistry or just boredom, but just consider the numbers. With Ethan, you hit the lottery your first shot. It takes a few tries, just based on odds, before you can expect to win again." This was just the kind of twisted Jilly logic that always sucked me in, the type that sounded outright crazy, until it didn't. "Fine," I said. "Have you seen the guy I'm supposed to be paired up with, or is he purely a theoretical?" "I have actually laid eyes on him. His name is Tyler. He had on a sport coat, too, for what it's worth." Which was nothing, as I saw enough formal wear. In my mind, though, I pictured rolling dice, slowly warming to the idea of aiming to gather losses rather than worrying about winning. If I really was cynical girl, then this was my kryptonite. Okay, I'll see you at 7:30.
All right,
she crowed, and I heard her beep the horn as punctuation.
That's my girl. I gotta go. Love ya.
Love ya back, I replied, although I was pretty sure she didn't hear me. As I put down my phone, I had a flash of the Jughead guy at the party. In her thinking, strike one. How many more before I'd earned a decent hit? I guessed I would find out. Just as I thought this, I saw the girl with the picnic basket coming back across the courtyard. At the exact same time, how was this possible? Ambrose and Hajar were approaching via the opposite entrance. They were holding hands, each of them carrying a cup from Lotus Sushi. Ira and I were in the middle, the dead center point where these two parties would collide. I felt my stomach clench. Ira started barking.
Ira!
Ambrose called out, seeing only the dog. Ira barked again, excited, while I made a point of looking directly at the girl with the basket, willing Ambrose to follow my gaze. Finally he did, suddenly slowing his pace, as if he could put off this confrontation with space alone. Nope.
Ambrose?
I heard Basket Girl say from my left-hand side.
Jenna!
He replied from my right. Beside him, Hajar, in a red maxi dress and sandals, gave a tentative smile.
You're here!
I brought you lunch, she said, not smiling at all, like we discussed last night. Now Hajar's face changed. She looked at Ambrose. I thought you stayed in last night.
I did,
he said quickly. Jenna put a hand on her hip, physically contesting this.
With Jenna, actually.
Now everyone looked tense, except for Ira, who was wagging away, trying to get to Ambrose. I'm going back to work, I said delicately, moving to step around the dog.
I should too, Ambrose said immediately. The boss is a real bear about lunch breaks.
He wasn't getting away that easily, though. Were you really with this girl last night? Asked Hajar as I slipped past her. Ira, having no luck with Ambrose, tried to follow, his nose bumping my leg.
You lied to me? I didn't lie, he said. The plan was to hang at her house and watch a movie, and...
He stayed until 3 a.m., Jenna finished. Him and his dog. Hajar looked at Jenna.
Well, did he tell you we were together this weekend? He went out to eat with my entire family.
Clearly, this was news to Jenna, who responded with, So you'd already done that when we met on Monday at the movie theater? I was clear of this threesome now, free to go. I felt bad for Ira, though, his stretched-out leash still tangled around one of Jenna's ankles, looking from the girls back to Ambrose like a confused child.
Monday? Hajar demanded. You said you had to stay home with your sister. Who then decided she wanted to go to a movie? Ambrose said quickly.
Glares at him from both directions.
Ladies, I did go to the movies Monday, and I stayed in last night. I haven't been untruthful to anyone here.
Oh, so you don't lie, Jenna said. You just don't tell the whole truth. Is there a difference? Hajar asked.
Well, if we're splitting hairs, Ambrose said, then yes. It's vast, actually.
Vast? Jenna repeated, whether because she didn't get the sentiment or the word itself, I wasn't sure. Hajar, over the semantics, just loosened the top of her drink and threw the contents at Ambrose, then walked away.
Whoa, I thought as Ira dove for the ice cubes.
Jenna unwound his leash from her foot, then shifted the basket to the other arm.
Well, Ambrose said, rather magnanimously, smiling at her, and then there were two.
You're an asshole, she replied. Then she walked away as well. In the silence that followed, I wished more than ever that I'd abandoned this scene when I had the chance. I was embarrassed enough, I couldn't imagine how Ambrose felt. But as he crouched down in front of Ira, shirt stained wet with cola, and scratched his ears, he appeared largely unaffected, as if this kind of thing happened all the time. "She left you a note," I told him, just to say something. "Jenna, before, when she came by."
"Oh, thanks."
He stood again, then checked Ira's bowl.
"But I'm pretty sure whatever it says no longer pertains."
I nodded, then started toward the office. A moment later, he fell into step behind me. I said, "Can I ask you something?"
"Sure."
So agreeable. I was beginning to think this was a regular occurrence. "Why do you do that?"
"Do what?"
I stopped and faced him, shielding my eyes with one hand. "Juggle two girls at once. It clearly won't work, at least not for long, and you can't enjoy getting busted."
"Well," he replied, "I don't consider it busted. I didn't lie to anyone, nor did I make any promises about exclusivity."
"But it was clearly assumed."
"That's on them, not me."
I cocked my head to the side, making it clear I doubted this logic.
"Look, I like hanging out with girls, plural. Commitment doesn't really work for me."
"Maybe because you're always hanging out with girls, plural?" I suggested.
"No," he countered. "Because it's too serious. Everything gets, like, heavy immediately. And all the questions. Where are you going? Who with? When will you be back? Why haven't you called? What's that glitter in your hair?"
"Glitter?" He sighed.
"Let me put it this way. You know that feeling when you very first meet someone and there's a spark, that undeniable attraction, and everything about them seems new and interesting and perfect?"
A boy on a beach, his hand outstretched, white shirt billowing in the dark. "Yeah," I said. "Sure."
"It's the best, right? Like, magic. That awesome."
I nodded.
"So why, if you could, wouldn't you want that all the time, every time?"
"Because," I said, then realized immediately this was not an answer. I swallowed, taking a breath. "Then you only have beginnings, over and over again. Nothing substantial."
"But substantial is complicated." "Substantial," he said, pointing at me, "is questions about glitter in your hair, or why you won't tag along shopping, or whether you find her friends annoying."
"So you don't want anything that lasts," I said, clarifying. "Only a bunch of magical first nights and days strung along one right after the other." He smiled.
"Doesn't sound bad, does it? All the upsides of dating, none of the down."
"Except when you get a drink thrown at you," I pointed out. He shrugged.
"Shirts can be washed."
We started walking again. It had been over an hour for each of us, and while my mom wasn't exactly a bear, she would notice.
"Let me guess," he said. "You think I'm terrible."
"Not necessarily. It's just not my way, I guess." I thought for a second. What's funny is that Jilly was just saying, basically, that I need to be more like you.
"Really?"
I nodded.
"How so?"
I paused, wondering how exactly to say this, what I wanted to reveal. "My last relationship, my boyfriend, it was basically all one perfect early beginning. We met at the beach, clicked immediately, spent a whole night talking. Then we were long distance, so there was never a chance of anything getting old." He was quiet, listening to this.
"Sounds nice."
"It was." I swallowed again. "Anyway, I haven't dated since. I haven't wanted to. And she maintains it's because my expectations were set so high right off the bat, like no one will ever compete."
"Do you think that?"
"I don't know," I said. This was the truth. "But maybe going into things hoping they will is the wrong approach. Like, if I date someone expecting nothing, I'd be better off."
"I don't expect nothing of the person," he corrected me. "Just the relationship."
You're just having fun, though, I said. No ties, no forever.
Ugh, no, he winced. And who wants to be tied?
I didn't mind it with my boyfriend, I said, which is exactly why your way wouldn't work for me. He considered this.
Sure it would. You just have to do it.
Oh, right, I said, because it would be that easy for you to change your ways totally.
I could, he said, confident.
Ambrose, you're seriously saying that it would be no problem at all for you to decide to date only one person with an eye toward the long term, starting right now?
Yeah, if I wanted to. Easily.
We were at the office door now. Through the glass, I could see my mom and William at the conference table, that week's bride, Eleanor Lynn, between them. She was smart and gorgeous and had already had a dramatic vocal meltdown about napkin holders. It was mid-June of my last summer doing this job. If I couldn't sell cucumbers or sling coffee, maybe there was another way to endure.
Want to bet on it? I asked Ambrose.
He raised an eyebrow. I'm listening.
What about this? I said. For a set period, I agree to date the way you do. Multiple people, no commitment. At the same time, you find one girl and see her exclusively. We see who bows out first.
Oh, it'll be you, he said confidently.
We haven't even set the stakes, I said, offended.
I'm very competitive, he explained. Okay, specifics. What's the time period?
3 weeks? I wasn't totally sure, but I thought I saw him waver. What, too long?
I was thinking maybe not long enough, he replied. If I'm going to commit, I need to really go for it.
4, I said.
7. That will get us to Bee's wedding.
I had to admit, I was surprised.
Agreed. Other fine print? You can't just go on a couple of dates and call it multiple because that's what it would be for you. If you're going to be me, you have to be all me. Lots of dates, like every night.
Ambrose, I said. I have to work.
I work?
I just looked at him.
Let's say you have to do at least 3 a week.
3? I said. 1.
Please, he replied, looking offended. 2 or no deal.
I sighed. Fine, 2 it is. And what does the winner get? He leaned against the door, rubbing his chin like it actually helped him think.
If I win, I get to decide who you go out with next. And it can be anybody. You can't dispute or refuse. No takesies-backsies.
Takesies-backsies? What are you, 12? I said. And what about if I win?
You won't, he said, again so confidently. But if we're talking hypothetical, that would mean I couldn't be a one-woman man, so you also get to pick my next prospect.
I stuck out my hand. I have to admit, I said, I'm not totally sure why you're agreeing to this.
Because you think I can't do it, he replied, and it's only for 7 weeks.
After which, I said, you'll go back to dating the entire town and getting drinks thrown at you.
While you, he added, will be stuck with the person of my choosing, demanding the origin of the glitter in your hair.
We shook. It was a rare thing for me, lately or otherwise, to feel going into something that I already had an edge. But this time, I did. It was just dating, all beginnings, no endings. He was right. It did sound nice. And anyway, how hard could it be?
Chapter 12.
Okay, Devin said, holding up his hand. Legionnaires.
As Tyler thought for a second, then jotted on his napkin, I tried to catch Jilly's eye, but she was studying her water glass, or pretending to.
Got one! He announced. No way, Devin said.
Yup. Tyler cleared his throat loudly. Reasoning lie.
Nice, Devin said, reaching across the table for a high five.
the 10th since I'd started counting soon after we sat down. Each one sounded a louder slap than the rest, but again, that might have just been me.
My turn. Tyler looked at me. You want to get in on this yet? Run with the big dogs?